This session, as I said, is the Mass Strike. The introduction is going to be presented by Omar. Omar's a member of the Thursday branch of Socialist Alternative and on the National Committee. He's been a member of ours for a number of years, one of our leading activists. So I'll hand it over to Omar. Make him feel welcome.
Thank you. Anyway, who's actually read this pamphlet? Can I just get a sense?
Good.
That's very good.
Oh, even in the back there.
Great. I think it's really a wonderful pamphlet, a work of genius. I would go so far to say, both in terms of its style, it's wonderfully written, but also its content. I mean, it's hard to overemphasize how radical the pamphlet was in its time. It was reflecting on the 1905 Russian Revolution, which was the first revolution in human history that was really led consciously by the working class, and the first where working class organizations of power were formed. And Luxembourg is the first Western writer to be reflecting on, theorizing, and popularizing this very important experience. Her pamphlet goes into great lengths explaining the rise and development of the strike wave and the revolution in Russia in 1905. And she emphasizes the spontaneous, the creative, and the powerful character of this movement and its rank and file nature. And her argument was a full-scale assault on the union officials and conservative moderate party leaders in Germany who she worked with, where strikes and political movements were seen as sort of top-down, hyper-organized, regimented affairs. And as a polemic against these leaders, it's pretty devastating. You'll pick up the kind of sardonic humor that's sort of laced throughout the book. She denounces the conservative union officials for their kind of evolutionary attitude to social change and to class struggle and to revolution, which is really a product of the SPD's history. You know, the SPD is a party which had built up over 20, 30 years of kind of legal work. Actually, less than that legal work, about 15 years of legal work, but, you know, 30 years of kind of steady growth, pretty patient stuff, not a lot of controversy or clashes with the German state in substance. And, you know, for that reason, they had sort of tennis clubs, hockey clubs, you know, book reading circles, all sorts of ephemeral institutions that a working class party, you know, it's a bonus, but it's not particularly central to the cause of overthrowing capitalism. So she was polemicizing against this conservatism. And Luxembourg used the 1905 revolution in Russia as a kind of intervention into this organization to try and reorient it back towards a revolutionary policy. And in particular, she tried to argue that revolutions and revolutionary struggles and mass strikes as a prelude to that, they don't come gradually over time, building up in straight lines. They come in waves and in leaps, as Lenin would later say. But not only did Luxembourg argue that the mass strike happened like this, but that this was actually obviously a prelude towards social revolution. And I guess there are two ways this talk could go, right? I could either spend a lot of time looking at the context of Germany and Russia at that time, go through the historical side of things, but I decided not to do that. We're living in an era where mass strikes are back on the agenda. So I'm going to try and take out the kernels of wisdom, and there are many from her text, to try and deal with the mass strikes that are happening today and the possibilities of future development for the class struggle globally. So, Luxembourg's argument is premised on two particular aspects. The first is that the mass strike is crucial for raising the class consciousness, social consciousness, and, you know, just general political consciousness of the working class as a whole, and that process is crucial to that. And secondly, that being involved in mass strikes is inherently politicizing our process, whereby workers inevitably come up against the bourgeois state, its repressive apparatus, and therefore learn political lessons about the need for total social revolution. And although there are qualifications to this that I'll talk about later, I think she's absolutely right to describe the mass strike as the living pulse beat of the revolution, and at the same time, its most powerful driving wheel. Elsewhere, she says, "It is not a crafty method of making proletarian struggle more effective, but the phenomenal form of the proletarian struggle in revolution." Okay, now Luxembourg's pamphlet was written about a very specific strike, the 1905 Russian Revolution, that strike process. And this was probably the most revolutionary strike in history, either, you know, definitely at the time and probably to this day. So I don't think it's fair or useful to judge her pamphlet, you know, use her pamphlet as a template for every strike that's followed. You know, does it live up to the 1905 experience? Is it exactly the same? Are workers as spontaneously, creatively out of control of their leaders and so on? I don't think that's a very useful approach. So I'm going to try and distill some of the key features. So what are they? The first is that it involves enormous sections of the working class, independently of prior organisation. And this is obviously what socialists want to do in class struggle. We want to organise as many workers as possible. We want them to be fighting in a coherent and large way as possible. And there are many debates about how this can be done. And historically and to this day, there are conservative union officials who argue you can't have a big struggle until you have a big union. You can't have a big struggle until everyone's already on board. You can't have a struggle until people are thinking the same way and workers are all ready for it and organised as a big sort of solid army ready to march on the bosses. But Luxembourg makes a very interesting point. She says there are large sections of the working class who are not organised and who will never probably be organised until some radical crisis or social shake-up occurs, forcing them into action, inspiring them into action, another way of putting it. So actually, there are some sections of workers who will never be interested in gradual union reform and build-up, but actually require something a bit more drastic to awaken them. And there are many examples. My favourite one of this occurred in France in 1936. There was a wave of factory occupations, right? And there was workers in department stores one day decided to get on board. Now, you think about workers in department stores, what do? Manicures, they make suits, they fit shoes, etc. It's hard to imagine them kidnapping bosses, taking them out in wheelbarrows, dumping them on the street, etc. But that's exactly what happened in this strike wave. And you had, you know, these department stores, think Meyer, David Jones, going from being totally ununionized, totally untouched by the class struggle in history, going to close shops. They won something like they won enormous wage rises. And basically, many became closed shops. And this is in the context of a broad social struggle. And so actually, it took the key sections of the working class going into serious confrontation with the bosses to actually create a social situation where other workers could follow. And I think we've seen that more recently in places like Greece, a couple of years ago in France, where big strikes by kind of industrial, proletariat, key sections of industry have been able to draw in behind them enormous support and awaken enormous energy amongst the rank and file workers. And I think the two things are key here, that there's a unity between workers, but there's also an unevenness which is only really overcome in the process of struggle. But it can work the other way. I mean, the Egyptian Revolution in 2010, people might not know, but before that there was a strike wave. Yeah? Went for about 3 years, started in 2006. And it was started by about 3,000 women workers, textile workers, who were not in any union, who decided to skip work and go on strike. They marched to their factories, and they were chanting, you know, here are the women, where are the men? And essentially, from this, spiraled an enormous strike wave throughout Egypt, and which once, you know, the figure I quoted earlier, 325% wage rises, and things that are pretty unimaginable. Basically, workers across the industries that were more unionised were following these women textile workers. And this lesson, I guess, shows that sometimes the most downtrodden and oppressed workers can be the most explosive in periods of struggle. Okay, the next feature is the rank and file initiative. Rosa Luxemburg is really the first theorist of the rank and file in a conscious way. She talks about the importance of the working class at a grassroots level, organising and striking for itself. And she mocks the kind of bureaucratic vision of a mass strike, which was common in Germany then, and I think to some extent still these days. She describes the bureaucrat's vision as a single grand rising of the industrial proletariat, undertaken on the basis of an opportune and mutual understanding on the part of the controlling authorities, both of the new party and of the trade unions, and carried out in the spirit of party discipline and in perfect order. So you can imagine, you know, workers one day are told, meet us outside the factory gates, 9 o'clock, everywhere in the country, and simultaneously there's a beautiful march to somewhere in the city. And she mocks this. But it has actually happened. It's happened many times in history. For example, in Belgium, 1913, there was a general strike called, it's wonderful, 13 months in advance, the union leaders decide on a general strike. They plan soup kitchens. And they plan these soup kitchens in such a way so there's no more than 200 workers at any one soup kitchen at any one time. You can guess why? Because more than 200 workers, well, that could become a rally. They specify 20 recipes for each soup kitchen. And they provide them in advance with all the ingredients necessary for each recipe and nothing else, right? So extreme, you know, limitations. They organise tours to museums and art galleries well in advance, like 13 months in advance. And no more than 25 people on any tour, because that could also become a protest. Okay, so things aren't usually that extreme, right? Union leaders aren't usually that organised. But I think there is a tendency to view strikes as this kind of the leadership trying to organise and mobilise the base in as tightly controlled way as possible. Well, Luxembourg was the first person to reject this, and we talk about it all the time, the rank and file, but she was really the first to go through it and insist on class struggle unionism from below. And she insists on the power and creativity of a working class that's been kind of repressed for so long. But she doesn't do this purely for tactical reasons in terms of winning a particular strike or struggle against a particular boss or even, you know, governmental reform. But her emphasis on the rank and file is precisely because she believes the rank and file will lead and must lead a future revolution. And so it's only by the rank and file being involved in the struggle directly in a relatively uncontrolled way, at least to start with, that they can get a sense of their own power and be educated through that process. Again on France, great examples. May 68, right? Factory occupations happen yet again. They love them in France. The first day of this factory occupation, one particular factory, they put up a banner. It says, for better wages and better pensions. Day two, for a socialist party, communist party, trade union government. Same place, change the banner. Day three, new banner, for workers' control of production. Now, that's not your kind of standard evolution, but it is a possible one, and a one that Luxembourg was the first to point to. And so she was really the first to theorise how the self-emancipation of the working class was an inherent part of every serious mass strike. Okay, so involving the majority of workers, rank and file initiative, these are all breakthroughs. The third thing that Luxembourg talked about and emphasised was that mass strikes have an internal logic of development, in which the political and the economic can become intertwined and reinforcing each other, and which minor struggles can develop towards social confrontations, which can then develop towards social revolution. And I think, returning to Egypt, workers of one factory became workers in all, many factories, not all, which became, calling for independent trade unions on an economic basis, which then came up against the state security of the government, which then became the first independent union movement, and chanting anti-regime slogans and that kind of thing. And this is really the most impressive insight of her pamphlet, I think. The fact that she could see the way the mass strike could start from an economic, relatively kind of apolitical point and end in an extremely political movement. And she writes, cause and effect continually change place. The economic and the political factor in the period of the mass strike are not widely removed, completely separated, or mutually exclusive, as a theoretical plan would have them. She's referring to debates in the German party at the time. They merely form the two interlacing sides of the proletarian class struggle in Russia. Okay, so how does this work? Well, often economic strikes can be easier. Uniting workers to struggle around a basic wage issue or a condition can be a kind of an instinctive response to an attack by the boss or whatever. And so these basic economic strikes can seem legitimate and so on. But then as they grow, and particularly in periods of social crisis, the boss they're fighting against can often become very close to the state, the bourgeois state, which represents those bosses. And so making even partial economic demands can quickly put workers up against the state apparatus, and then obviously that leads to deepening demands around the nature of the police, repression and so on. So economic action can become political in that direction. But she also talked about the other way. I think there are plenty of examples from history as well which go the other way. I mean, a political crisis or a political victory just a change in the political situation in a country can also lead to economic struggle. Some good examples are Egypt, January of last year. There was a political movement, primarily. I mean, it was economic demands were certainly in there, but it was a social movement in the squares. And once Mubarak was toppled, that then unleashed a wave of economic action. Yeah, so there can be interaction the other way. And so, and it's not just, you know, mutually kind of alternating economic, political, economic. But the point that Luxembourg makes is, with every change, there's a deeper penetration into the roots of the system. So you can start with, you know, getting rid of the regime official, which is a political achievement, but you've still got the state untouched. So then you organise partial economic strikes. Then you realise that in the factories there are these mini Mubaraks who are essentially tied to the political regime. So then you centralise and begin protesting those on a you know, regional level or a national level. Then you come up against SCAF, and then you start to oppose SCAF and calling for a continuing revolution. And so it's not just that they're alternating, it's that they're deepening at the same time. Okay. And there's clearly not a linear progression in this process as well. I mean, we saw in Egypt there are months at a time where you feel like nothing's happening, it looks like it's all quiet, but of course things are bubbling away under the surface. And in the original, for those who read it, in 1905 in Russia, between January and October, there was, whatever that is, 9 months, where very little public action was taking place in that country. Okay, so as I've said, they're the three features. Rank and file initiative involving massive workers and the political and the economic relationship of the struggle. Key features of mass strikes that Luxembourg has identified for the first time in her pamphlet. And it's pretty important and serious stuff. And it really cemented her as one of the key theoreticians, both of the revolutionary left in the SPD, which was unfortunately small but important, and the worldwide communist movement at the time and to this day. But there are some weaknesses of the pamphlet, I think, that history really has kind of brought to light, which are worth talking about, even though Luxembourg, to some extent, can't be blamed because she's sort of creating new paths here where no one else had been, when where the struggle itself had not taken her. So Luxembourg, for example, placed enormous emphasis on the spontaneous character of the 1905 general strike and revolution generally. She writes, "Events would not stop for a second in order to ask the union leaders whether they had given their blessing to the movement or not. If they stood aside for the movement or opposed it, union or party leaders would be swept away by the wave of events, and the economic as well as the political struggles would be forced to their conclusion without them." And Luxembourg is often caricatured in a way as having this position as a general position that she didn't support the political organisation, whatever. And that's not true. Most of the socialists writing at this time, including Trotsky, were pretty underemphasised the role of the Revolutionary Party, partly because the revolution itself was relatively spontaneous and the political organisations took a while to catch up, that particular one. But she was not alone in this process. But the difference between Luxembourg and Lenin and Trotsky was that Luxembourg was operating in a Western country where the unions and the reformist institutions of parliament and so on were much more deeply ingrained into society. And so where in Russia the kind of state superstructure, the unions were very weak, in Germany they were very strong. You know, Gramsci's talked about this. And so overcoming this reformist apparatus is not as easy as that quote makes it sound. And, I mean, Luxembourg herself identified this later, but it was pretty much too late. I mean, she was killed precisely by the reformist apparatus that she spent all her life building, the SPD. And I think really the problem with Luxembourg is that she failed to generalise her kind of dialectical understanding of the relationship between politics, economics, to understand the relationship between a political organisation and the class as a whole. She failed to overcome the binary there. She basically was operating in a situation where the party, the SPD, was hyper-organized, hyper-centralized, and so on. And so she wanted to emphasize the other side of the equation, understandable. But in doing so, her pamphlet has a weakness, which means that it doesn't actually provide a coherent manual for how to go forward and intervene in these kinds of situations. As we've since discovered in Germany and elsewhere, that revolutionary situations can be created by mass strikes and are often created by mass strikes, but the possibility is created, the outcome is not determined, and so subjective intervention then becomes crucial. But I think, well, short of revolution, this is true as well. conservative officials can intervene, even in mass strikes that are very spontaneous in nature. I mean, the May 68 strike was quite spontaneous. I mean, the student revolt that initiated it was totally out of the control of the CP, which is the dominant party of the left in France. Very rank and file, a lot of pressure there. But the leaders don't just sit back and watch. You know, they have an active interest in preserving the status quo, and so they were able to intervene to argue for the strike to end, and then argue for elections, which they subsequently lost. And I think you can compare the radical strike waves in Egypt that we've seen to the situation in Spain or Britain, to see what role that trade union leaders can play, even when disaffection and anger is real and widely present. Okay, so it was difficult for Luxembourg to deal with this kind of issues because there'd never really been this kind of struggle in a Western country. So I don't totally blame her for that. But I think for us here today, it's important to conceive of mass strikes and of class struggle not as an either-or, you know, either the working class rank-and-file initiative sweeping away the union officials and everyone else, or totally top-down. But we have to understand there's going to be a blend of both, particularly in a situation like today where the rank and file is quite weak. There is going to be union leadership. There will always be, in the West and in places where unions exist, leadership. Our role is not to counterpose ourselves to that in some ultra-sectarian way, but to try and strengthen the rank and file within this process, to try and argue for whatever rank and file organisations can be formed to strengthen the self-activity of workers and so on. And exactly how you do that is very concrete. But I think understanding that you can always have both elements is really crucial. Okay, the final point I think that's interesting for us today, and this is something that Luxembourg couldn't have predicted either, is that even bureaucratic mass strikes in the right context can lead to development in the working class, in the right context, of course. There was not much development in Belgium in 1913, I'm sure. But in Greece right now, there has clearly been development. Greek socialist Panos explained the development in a recent interview in the ISJ. He explained, at first you would say that people would obey the strike call, they wouldn't go to work, but they wouldn't be involved in organising or demonstrations or anything like this. But that changed. It became clear with every general strike, people were remembering more and more ways of organising that had not been seen since the 1970s. There were mass meetings in workplaces, strike committees elected, and there were pickets in places where the strike was not solid. And the demonstrations themselves became more radical in what they were demanding. And even, you know, and beyond this, there's been a trend in Greece towards occupations and self-government of the workers of their institutions, such as the occupied hospital in Kilkis, which has been occupied by doctors and nurses from the 5th of February, and also the centre-left newspaper Eleftherotypia, which has been occupied by its writers and journalists for about a few months now. Their new paper has a broader circulation than the old one, and so maybe that's a solution for the Australian. But the fact that these actions weren't happening at the beginning of the strike wave shows that in Greece, even just going off on set-piece strikes month after month, you do that often enough, workers, there's a trajectory towards it. You know, you remember the past and you want to do something one step more. You want to do a little bit more. And so you maybe ask your workers to do something extra, or you ask your colleagues to go to that rally, or you paint a more radical banner or something. So in a crisis like we're seeing globally, I think even the tentative bureaucratic strikes we're seeing, we should feel optimistic that they are going to lead to a crystallisation of a new layer of activists and so on. Okay. We've seen this crystallisation and this process unfolding in Europe in the last few years. We've seen bureaucratic strikes and revolutionary strikes from the Middle East to Europe to now Chile, which we're all missing out on by being here. And despite the qualifications I've made in my talk, I think Luxembourg's pamphlet is really an invaluable read in this context, and it really is a must-read for anyone who's seriously trying to understand the development of the strike wave and the revolutionary struggles across the world today, and especially those who are trying to intervene in them, as we will one day here in Australia, and as our international comrades, I'm sure, will as well. In Italy, Spain and Britain, the rounds of centralised strikes are obviously limited, but there is development. But I think in Greece, the situation is the most interesting. There's clearly a blend of the set-piece actions become a focal point around which other actions are organised. So you see now there are tales of strikes that go for weeks before the set piece one, and then those that start the week of and go afterwards, you know, the occupations that are happening and so on. And so this is beyond the control of the union officials centrally. But on the other hand, if the central piece, the set piece actions weren't happening, it's not clear whether those things would happen. So there's a relationship between spontaneity and the set piece organising that I think is important to have the grips with. And the development in Greece is clear. I mean, 43% of people are going to vote for the far left in the next elections. 33% of people polled in February said that there should be a socialist revolution right now in Greece. I mean, 33%. In Australia, we're happy if 30% of people support refugee rights at any particular time. So clearly this process has radicalised and politicised an enormous section of the Greek working class. But I think the other thing we need to keep in mind in this context is that without revolutionary political organisation, this quite instinctive, quite explosive process of struggle will not necessarily lead to victory. And so I guess the task for revolutionaries around the world is to build up organisations that are both interventionist, kind of humble, but also serious about trying to lead our political movements to the conclusions that we need them to go to in the future.